Okay. Tough. So, page 14. Hope to finish chapter 4 today. Let's move some major ground. Okay, so holding over in chapter 14, where the Rav speaks about the different echoes of longings of religious man that's found within secular knowledge. And we spent a couple of good couple of weeks on a lot of the different philosophers that he mentions here. So I want to finish, but let's just quickly go through the other ones that he brings. He brings three more philosophical schools that have yearnings for transcendence. So let's just go through them quickly. We were up to Husserl. Let's see, the revival of the dualism, yeah? We spoke already about Spinoza, we spoke about Kant. So in the middle of the page, the line begins with the word absolute. He says, the revival of the dualism of essence and existence, which was so prevalent in Arabic philosophy and Christian scholasticism, in the phenomenological approach of Husserl and Scheller. Okay, so there's a lot to talk about here, but I would like to move a little, so let's just do this quickly. So first of all, when we speak about Arabic philosophy, so a lot of Jews, when they see Arabic philosophy, they get nervous, because we like to think that Arabs are, you know, the enemy or whatever, which obviously is not true for most Arabs. There's a minority of some nasty ones. But Arabic philosophy is certainly not the enemy. What most people don't realize is that Jewish philosophy is based on Arabic philosophy. I don't need to tell you. The Rambam, which we speak about as the philosopher par excellence, is based on Greek philosophy. His system, the Mor Nevuchim, the God of the Perplexed, is based on Greek philosophy. But the Rambam was not the first Jewish philosopher. He might have been the greatest, but he wasn't the first. The first Jewish philosopher was, of course, Reb Sadia Gaon. Reb Sadia Gaon, in the 9th century already, wrote his Emunas V'Deis, the Books of Beliefs and Opinions, and he began, really introduced philosophy into Judaism. Reb Sadia Gaon began what the Rambam sort of finished. And the Rambam was actually a reaction. The Rambam, when he wrote The God of the Perplexed, was a reaction or response to the Jewish philosophers that came before him. Reb Sadia Gaon and the schools that came after Reb Sadia Gaon. You know what the reaction was? Reb Sadia Gaon's philosophy was based on Arabic philosophy. Arabic philosophy known as the Kalam. The Kalam was the Arabic school of philosophy, which was essentially, what was the Kalam about? The Kalam were the Arabic philosophers that took Greek philosophy, which was, of course, the Greeks were the source of philosophy, and the Kalam wanted to synthesize Greek philosophy with monotheism. And therefore they watered down Greek philosophy and came up with a whole new system of Arabic philosophy, which was monotheism, philosophy with monotheism. And that was Reb Sadia Gaon. Essentially, he took these Arabic philosophers and he based his system, the Jewish philosophy, on the Kalam, on Arabic philosophy. What the Rambam ended up doing 200 years later was the Rambam was not pleased with the fact that these Arabic philosophers and the Jewish philosophers that followed them, that they watered down Greek philosophy. The guy that perplexed is essentially one point to the whole book. That is to show that Greek philosophy, Aristotle, in his pristine state, could still be synthesized with Torah. That was the Rambam's point. That's essentially what he's doing over there. He's saying you don't have to water down Aristotle. You don't have to follow the Kalam, the Mikutalim, or the Methuselites, and the different schools of Arabic philosophy that Reb Sadia Gaon was based on. You could keep Greek philosophy as is, Aristotle, and could still fit with Torah. That's what the Rambam is doing. So Arabic philosophy is really the source of all Jewish philosophy. Now, I do need to say, obviously, this goes without saying, as a frum Jew, as Orthodox Jews, we do take what the Rambam says seriously. The Rambam makes a claim in the 71st chapter of the first part of The God of the Perplexed. He makes a claim which the academics will never let him live down, this claim. The academics are very unhappy with what the Rambam says, but we as frum Jews, we believe the Rambam. If he says it, we believe it's true. The Rambam does say, in the 71st chapter, the Rambam says that the Kalam is based on the Greek philosophy, or watering down Greek philosophy, but really the first philosophers we all know were the Greeks. Aristotle, and before him Plato, and before him Socrates. But the Rambam says, where did the Greeks get it from? The Rambam doesn't say the Greeks got it from God. He has a more quote-unquote academically outrageous claim. He says that the Greeks got it from Chazal, from the Jews. He says that all the Greek philosophers, that they got it from the Jews. That really when Chazal spoke in a cryptic language in the Talmud, because, you know, if you read the Talmud, it doesn't have one word of philosophy. It's one of the most interesting things in Jewish literature, that you read the entire body of the Talmud, not one word of theology, philosophy, mysticism. There are hints to them, but not openly spoken about. But the Rambam says that Chazal had philosophy, but they lost it. We lost it because of the Golus. And that's why the Rambam said that when you're learning Greek philosophy, you're learning Chazal. The Rambam had no problem to say that Maisa Merkava and Maisa Bereishis is Aristotle's physics and metaphysics. Because according to the Rambam, Chazal were philosophers. And that's where the Greeks got it from. Of course, the academics do not accept this idea of this claim of the Rambam. But we as Frum Jews, obviously, we believe that it's true. But the bottom line, therefore, we understand, as believing Jews, we know that the Arabic philosophers got it from the Greeks, the Greeks got it from Chazal, and therefore, we could all say it's all part of Torah at some level. It's definitely all part of Torah. So the Rav is saying here, prevalent in Arabic philosophy and Christian scholasticism. Christian scholasticism was in the Middle Ages after the Rambam wrote his book. The Rambam synthesized Aristotle with Torah. What followed him was Thomas Aquinas, the famous Christian theologian Thomas Aquinas, who then took the Rambam's idea of synthesizing Aristotle with monotheism, and he did it for the Christians. And Thomas Aquinas is and that's what scholasticism means. Scholasticism is the general term that's used for all medieval philosophy. The philosophers during the Middle Ages who were essentially working with a basic religious bend, and they were sort of synthesizing religion with philosophy. Thomas Aquinas has an entire book about what the Rav is mentioning here. An entire book about essence and existence. An entire book about essence and existence. So what he's saying is that there was a revival of the dualism, which I'm going to explain in a second, of essence and existence, which was so prevalent in Arabic philosophy because Aristotle already speaks about it. Aristotle in his Metaphysics speaks about it. So it was very prevalent in Arabic philosophy by the Aristotle and then by the Arabic philosophers based on Aristotle, the Kalam, and then Christian scholasticism, and it was revived in the phenomenological approach of Husserl and Scheller, meaning more modern philosophy. So without getting too much into it, let's talk a little about what's this whole thing about essence and existence. Let's talk a little about it. What's essence and existence? What does it mean? So let's have a little fun. Let's get philosophical. Because the only way to really appreciate when we speak about the philosophy of the dualism of essence and existence is really to like speak a little about it. All right. So you have the atheists, which is my pet peeve, that the atheists come along and they say and they make that declaration, it's impossible to prove the existence of God. Agnostics will say they don't know. You know, by the way, what happens if you have a, what's the word for person, dyslexic, insomnia, you know that one? A dyslexic, agnostic with insomnia. You know, Mati, what happens if you have a dyslexic, agnostic with insomnia? A person that stays up all night thinking if there's really a dog. Anyway, so that's an agnostic. But you have, of course, the atheists that say you cannot prove the existence of God, right? And what really gets, this is my pet peeve, is when they have the chutzpah, you know, especially these days, you know, these years, the atheists are very militant. Very militant in the end, you know, the Dawkins and Hitchens, Zichrono Livracha, and all, you know, that whole school that they're making a lot of money by being atheists. They're very, and of course, they're always very humorous and they always like to make fun of religious people. And the famous line that Dawkins writes, this is famous, you know, this is the high priest of atheism. He says, nobody believes anymore in Zeus, and nobody believes anymore in Thor, and nobody believes anymore in you know, the many gods. So there's just one left. Just one god left that we have to get rid of. Because all the other ones we managed to, we were mature enough to outgrow, so we have just one more. One more to the list, you know, now that all the other gods and goddesses are gone, there's just, you know, the god of J, or you know how they call it, Y-A-H-W-E-H, you know, the only, that's the last one, the last god that's still hanging around that we haven't managed to get rid of. And then they go so far as to say, you know, I read one atheist, he's like, you know, and my 6-year-old child said to me, well, Daddy, if God created everything, who created God? And he's so blasé that even a 6-year-old knows how to ask the ultimate question that disproves monotheism. Because even a 6-year-old knows how to ask that question, well, if God created everything, who created God? And so you see, anyone that has the knowledge of a 6-year-old could see that that's the obvious thing you should be asking. Of course, what's inherently unfair with that whole pitch and that whole way of talking is that it completely circumvents the fact that pure logic and rationalism brings to the one God. The one God is not the same as Zeus and Thor. You know why? Because the whole belief in one God, or the rational understanding of the one God, is based on an understanding of the dualism of essence and existence. If you understand the dualism of essence and existence, you will understand that therefore, one has to come to an understanding if you use logic. Again, if you use pure logic. If you don't want to use logic, then fine. If we throw logic out the window, like we spoke about in the past, you can't prove anything. You can't prove that there's a reason not to jump off the window. But if you're using pure logic and you understand the dualism of essence and existence, it's not just something about having Zeus or something. It's not just another, you know, old man with a white beard. It's understanding the dualism of essence and existence. So again, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but let's have a little fun. So when somebody says to you, you can't prove that the God doesn't exist, could you prove that God exists? So some people will start by saying, what's proof, right? That's what logicians will say, let's discuss what proof means. That's an I like to get philosophical. Let's discuss, what does existence mean? So I'm opening up the floor. Who wants to volunteer? What does it mean to exist? Anyone want to try to, I mean, ever think about that? What does it mean to exist? What, define existence. Does prove to me that God exists. Well, let's begin by, that's a fair question, define exist. What does it mean to exist?
Be in a certain place at a certain time.
To be in a certain place at a certain time. That's what existence means. Okay. So, that means that, let's say, happiness. Does happiness exist? It is. Happiness exists?
If you're happy, then it exists.
If you're happy, it exists. So let's say you're not happy and nobody's happy. Happiness doesn't exist? Huh? And let me ask you something. Theoretically, if nobody's happy, happiness doesn't exist. So then there is an existence called happiness. Is there an existence called, let's say, for instance, by way of example, this table, it exists? Well, let's go one thing at a time. What? What do you say? There's no existence called happiness?
No.
What is it?
It's a
concept doesn't exist?
It's something some existent.
Some do, some don't.
It's something some existence experiences, but it's not an existence.
Is an experience not an existence?
No.
Well, why not?
Define the existence because if you don't exist.
But what does existence mean?
It doesn't stand on its own.
So one second. Existence mean it has to stand on its own?
Existence means it has to be something that
to be a real
entity.
Real entity. That's not answering the question. What does it mean to be a real entity? Because if you could feel it, I'm asking.
Something that thinks. Something that.
A rock doesn't exist.
Huh?
A rock doesn't exist.
The only way, you know, we went through this about 3 weeks ago when we said the only way we
can find substance.
Something existed is if we perceive it.
Well, that's a matter of debate. So let's say no. Let's first.
Independent of
one second.
Perception?
Let's say for a second there'd be a nuclear war and all human beings would die, so nothing would exist.
Yeah, things of substance.
Well, no, but we're trying to get philosophical of it. We're trying to get philosophical of it.
It has to have substance.
What does substance mean?
It has to have a. Made up of something.
Made up of something.
You're
made up of no. This is. Let me ask a question. Does this table exist?
Yes.
It exists. What happens if I burn it and it becomes ashes? Listen to the question. The table doesn't exist?
No.
So you mean the form doesn't exist? You mean
you
the...
You don't have a table anymore.
But you have the ashes. So what...
Have ashes.
So what is existence? The form?
Yeah.
Not the matter, you're saying. You're saying form, existence is having a certain form? I'm saying, so that, think for what we're saying. Let's think for a second. We're saying that if you have, it exists, but now if you burn it, it becomes ashes. So it doesn't, what doesn't exist? I mean, the matter is still there, it just changed its form. So shall we say the table doesn't exist? Does that mean that having existence is having a certain form? Because it's still here, the matter is still there, it just became ashes. So could we say that existence means specifically having a certain form?
You're asking objective?
I'm asking very objective, very philosophical.
Objective,
but I'm trying to show that there's absolutely no way to define existence. That's what I'm trying to get to.
You could define it as subjective existence.
Subjective existence is subjective. That's just around your little world. That's not existence.
Why can't you ask
me? I'm asking, what does it mean to exist? Not just in your world.
I'm sorry, but I have trouble defining things that are out of my world.
Okay. So then what do you want from God? That's exactly the point. And that's just you, by the way. Dawkins has the same issue. Because we can't define things out of there, but let's try to stay within our world for a second. Let me ask you another question. So we say happiness. Happiness seems to be, you're saying it's a state of mind. Why is that a less of existence? Let's take something other than happiness. I'll give you another one. An intellectual idea.
There's no form or matter.
Right. So let me ask you, forget happiness. An intellectual idea. Okay? An intellectual idea. A whole is the sum of its parts. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. Those are ideas, right? Do they exist? Let's say nobody in the world would be thinking about them. There would be a nuclear Armageddon, no human beings alive. Does a concept... Actually, Obama, I just saw recently, I got to give credit where credit is due. I was very impressed. I saw recently Obama, I don't know what he was speaking about. They were asking him about the new Pope or something, whatever. But Obama said about the new Pope, he says he has a lot of great ideas, and ideas are the most powerful thing in the world. And that's true. There's nothing in the universe, there's nothing in the world in history as powerful as ideas. Ideas exist. What is a liberal? Yeah, right. Especially liberal ideas. Yeah, those are pretty destructive, right? You can't get rid of them. They just stick around like, you know, unwanted guests. But no. So let's talk ideas. A whole of the sum of its parts. Is that not an existence? Is that not more of an existence than the table?
If there wouldn't be people, you wouldn't have ideas. You wouldn't have happiness or sadness or anything like that.
What? Why would you not have?
Not
the
tangible.
Fact that
it's not tangible.
Is so. You, are you saying that existence is based in tangibility?
Probably, yeah.
Existence means you have to be able to what? Be able to touch it. So gases don't exist.
No, gases you can measure.
You can
compress. You can measure.
So we're saying that existence is based on the fact whether I could experience it tangibly. Why is that more real? Let me ask you. The fact that a whole is the sum of its parts, an intellectual idea. An intellectual idea. Why is that not a realm of existence that's even more real than the table? Just because I can't feel it? It always is. An intellectual idea always is. It doesn't stop existing. Just because I can't touch it means that it doesn't exist. Existence is based on whether I could feel it.
Why can't you say existence is and it transcends space and time?
Okay, but you're right. It definitely transcends space and time. I agree with you. I think we're all agreed already that existence can't just be something that's within space and time. But we have to define, therefore, what is it? I'll ask you another thing. A concept. Like, let's give you, for example, taxes. The concept taxes. What do you say? They exist or they don't?
They do.
Taxes exist, right? A concept taxes. Does taxes exist? Or let's say love. Does love exist? Do these things only exist when they're actually being played out? What are taxes? What are taxes? Is it the actual money?
It's an idea.
I'm saying, so taxes, like when you actually, is taxes only the actual money that you pay? Or is there such an existence called taxes that's an existence? That's not based on actual paying. Happiness is an existence that you partake of when you're happy, but it's not based on the fact whether you're happy or not. I'll make it even more complicated. You ready? Now, hear what I'm about to say. I know Clinton ruined it for all philosophers, for all history. But the most difficult word to touch up, to translate, is the word is. Is, right? Yeah, I know you really ruined it. But let's try to define what the word is, right? What does it mean to is? A dog is big. Is seems to be conveying having existence, right? Is. John is happy. A dog is big. So is like a way of conveying some kind of time of existence, right? So if we say a dog is big, what exists? Dog or big?
Both?
No, just dog.
Just dog. Big doesn't exist?
No, both. Big is a description.
It is an adjective.
Is it? Does an adjective not? Does an adjective not exist?
It's a modifier.
Does a modifying attribute not exist? Of course it does.
Like this.
Huh?
It's not, because big is how you perceive something. Could be big to you. Could be small to somebody else.
You're exactly. So therefore, we would say therefore there's no real existence as being big.
The word big is not an existence.
but we understand that there is a type of we call being big or happy ways of existence. We call them that. We call being happy, I'm existing, my existence is happy. He's a bigger type of existence. The point is, it's an unending. Martin Heidegger has an entire book called Being and Time. Heidegger was the main disciple of Husserl. Husserl was the one that began this. That's essentially what phenomenology is all about. We've spoken about what's phenomenology. Phenomenology is the study of perception. Existence is the ultimate question of perception. Heidegger's entire book called Being and Time, and really all his works are about defining being. What does it mean to be? What does it mean to exist? How do you define existence? By the way, and then you could say, and what's essence? If existence is a type of attribute, so what's essence? So the truth is, I have to read to you from you that Heidegger wrote that the ultimate transcendent knowledge is the knowledge of being. And what he's trying to say is, can we perceive, could we define existence without entities, without particular entities? What is existence? And he says that Nietzsche made fun of this. Nietzsche, because again, this is already in Aristotle. In the first chapter of Metaphysics of Aristotle, he deals with this. What does it mean to be? And since Aristotle, scholars have been debating the specific Greek words that Aristotle uses. Half of Heidegger is trying to figure out those Greek words of that he uses to be, because the Greek word could be substance or not the same substance. I don't want to get, some of you might get squirmers, so I don't want to get too much into it. But much of early Christian theology is trying to decide Greek words when they speak about substance. When they're discussing the Son and the Father, if it's the same substance or not the same substance, it's all about trying to define what does it mean to be? What does it mean to partake of existence? What does it mean to partake of essence? Is essence our existence? Are they actually the same thing or are they different? So Nietzsche says that being is effect, listen to this, being is in effect nothing at all. It's a mirage, the most general, emptiest concept, the last wisp of evaporating reality. Nietzsche essentially doing away with all philosophical speculation. He says that being is in effect nothing at all. It is a mirage, the most general, emptiest concept, the last wisp of evaporating reality, to try to define what does it mean to exist? What does it mean in essence? Heidegger responded to Nietzsche. Nietzsche's claim that being, trying to understand what does it mean to be, to exist, is nothing at all. You know what Heidegger's response was? He said, Nietzsche, you're right. It is nothing in the literal sense that it is no thing. That's what nothing means. It is no thing. It has no particular entity, because pure being and pure nothing are exactly the same. Pure being and pure no thing is exactly the same. And yet we understand that when we try to encounter existence, it brings us to a feeling of dread, because we really understand that we have no idea what it is. We can't define what it is. We can't define what does it mean to exist. We don't have a real definition. We agree that we don't have a real definition. So you want to know if God exists? What, are you kidding? You want to prove that God exists? First, try to define what existence means. Obviously, if you say existence, if you're a person that doesn't think and thinks existence means that you could touch it, so then, yeah, God doesn't exist because you can't touch him. You can't put him in a little cage, you know, tuck his tail into the cage and close the door behind him. Those people that are trying to, you know, put God in a little cage, you won't be able to do that. Yeah?
What's that whole, like, line, I think, therefore I am?
therefore I am. That line is about defining the fact that I know I partake of some sort of existence. I must partake of some sort of existence because of the fact that I'm thinking. Right. But what is that? What is my existence? What does that mean that I exist? What does that mean?
You know that you exist.
You know that you partake of existence. Yeah, but we're trying to understand what is the existence and what is essence. Point being back, coming to Rav Soloveitchik, therefore we understand that in this school of thought is another example when one tries to delve into trying to capture and understand what existence and essence are, it is again bringing about that yearning for transcendence that he's been speaking about. Let's go further. The modern metaphysics which attempts to penetrate to absolute being, that of course is Hegel, which we've spoken about in the past, I'm not going to get into now, but Hegel's whole metaphysics is about trying to define what is absolute being. Again, absolute being, not just to define existence generally, but what does it mean to be as the absolute? What does absolute being mean? The entire doctrine, and this we've been mentioned over the past few weeks a couple of times, the entire doctrine of epistemological idealism is exactly what David just mentioned. Epistemology is the study of thought. And idealism means that all of existence is essentially idealism. It's all in my thought. That school of philosophy that says that really only exists as long as we're thinking about it. In other words, that school of philosophy says, absolute idealism says, if there was a nuclear war and no human beings would exist, there would be no existence. Because to exist is only when we perceive it. That's the school which subjects existence to thought and consciousness in all of the various forms in which it unfolded from Berkeley to Hermann Cohen. The famous Bishop Berkeley, that Bishop Berkeley said that existence is only when I'm thinking about it. There's no way to prove that something exists other than my thought. And there's the famous anecdote that's told of a contemporary of Berkeley. I don't remember his name offhand, but he was trying, they asked him, what do you think about Berkeley's philosophy that existence is only that I'm thinking about it? And he said, I disprove Bishop Berkeley so, and he kicked a rock. And he said, that's how I disprove Bishop Berkeley. You see that there's an existence other than my thought, which of course doesn't prove anything. But that again is a school of philosophy that's trying to say that everything is just essentially what we're thinking about. And all of reality is essentially our thought, which again, there is an element of truth to that in Judaism and Torah, we're not going to get into now. But again, Rav Soloveitchik is saying, if you study philosophy properly, it will make a person into a religious person. That's the God's honest truth. If you study philosophy, really study the philosophers and see what they say, it'll bring a lot of doubt and lack of clarity, but it'll break a person to a religious person yearning for transcendence. Let's go further. The concept of absolute values, which won for itself such an important place in modern ethical and epistemological theories. Absolute values is, again, the search for, is there absolute ethical values? That, of course, the most famous is when we speak about absolute values. Is there a value that's absolute? Is there a value that always is? Is there an ethical norm of behavior that one can say always has to be? And that, of course, you all know, the most famous is Kant. Kant's categorical imperative. Kant's categorical imperative, he said, the only way that we can know if something is absolutely ethical is if what? If it's an ethical behavior that you will always say that whatever you're doing should be universally recognized as the way to act. That's what Kant says. The only way you could have a value that's absolute is if you're always behaving in such a way that whatever you're doing, you would agree should be considered a universal value that everyone should always espouse. Huh? The what?
What's one example of that?
So Kant's example is as follows. Kant's example is that a world can't function in a way that somebody lies. You can't lie. The world can't function if a person lies. So an absolute, a categorical imperative, which means something that's an imperative categorically, always it's an imperative that you must act that way, is, for instance, never lie. And therefore Kant said, if a murderer comes to your door, your friend comes to your house and he says a murderer is chasing after him to kill him. And he comes to your house to come hide in your house. And the murderer comes to the door and says, is your friend hiding by you in your house? You would have to say, yes, he is.
No, you could not answer.
Or you could not answer, right. But if he says, you can't say that he's not. You could try to not answer, or you could try to slam the door in his face. You could call the police. You could shoot him. But you can't say you can't lie. Because anything that you would do has to always be universal has to apply to everyone at all times. That's Kant's famous categorical imperative. Again, without getting to the pilpul, he's been shot down for the past couple of centuries a million times and discussed. But the bottom line, Rav Soloveitchik again is bringing another example that philosophy, that secular knowledge is seeking absolute truth. Absolute truth, that's what philosophy is seeking. In liberal universities, they're no longer seeking that. That's true. But the Rav Soloveitchik is still speaking in the 50s when the humanities was still alive and kicking. Let's go further. Etc., etc. Yeah, it was just a couple of examples the Rav gave. Let's go further. All these constitute traces of religious thought, which yearns for its creator and rebels against the concrete reality that so entirely surrounds it. A soul overwhelmed by religious longings may, at certain times, stray amid the paths of secular knowledge. Now what Rav Soloveitchik is going to do, bottom of page 14. Now that we've understood, essentially if you remember what he's doing over here in chapter 4 is to explain, let's just quickly review, where Rav Soloveitchik was doing over here in chapter 4 is to explain how ontic pluralism comes, how ontological dualism comes from ontic pluralism. Let's just remind ourselves what that is. Ontic means that there's an essential status to the cheftza, to what the thing is itself. That's the ontic status of something. The ontic status is to understand the thing itself. Ontological means how you now deal with it. So Soloveitchik is explaining over here that there's an ontological dualism, which means there's the stance that you approach the world in a way that you see that there's a world, and yet there's a transcendent realm. And Soloveitchik taught us that what we've been speaking about in this paragraph that we just finished now is that even in secular realms, in secular studies, there are traces of this ontological dualism. This dual way of approaching reality, of looking at reality as having not just the one in front of you, but having a transcendent realm, okay? And he says that that religious disposition is also found in secular sources. But look what he says. Now he's going to, let's go further. Until now we were speaking about that ontological dualism by way of, in the philosophical way of looking at it. Says the Rav, this religious quest, however, does not confine itself solely to theoretical stances and abstract views. Once we understand that there's a dual view, this quest, this religious quest, this perception of reality as being dual, of there being the reality in front of you, and then this yearning for something transcendent, it does not confine itself solely to theoretical stances and abstract views. It's not just about philosophy, but breaks out of the theoretical realm into the realm of praxis and utility. In other words, we would say in Hebrew, how would we say in Hebrew what the Rav is saying? It says, there's a nafkamina lamaisa, right? That's what the Rav is saying over here. That it doesn't remain solely in the realm of theoretical stances, it breaks out of the realm into the realm of praxis and utility, which means there's a nafkamina. There's a nafkamina. What's the nafkamina? Okay, until now we've been saying that the religious man, and in some ways, secular man sees that there's a higher realm. There's an ontological dualism. He sees that the world in front of him is not all there is. But it breaks that into a practical utility, meaning that there's an afkamina. What's that? Look what he says. The search for transcendence, you know what the afkamina is? The search for transcendence is transformed into an ethical principle. It turns into a pillar of fire that lights the path before the religious individual. In other words, he's saying that once we understand that there is this dualism, this ontological dualism, there's the search for transcendence, it lights the path, it actually makes that now his life will change, will be different. Once you perceive that there is this higher reality. What's that? The ladder of ethical perfection. And as the Rav is saying like this, he's saying that once we understand that the world that we see in front of us is not all there is, if we have a perception that there are higher, more pristine realms that transcend us, our lives can't be the same. What he means to say that it turns into a pillar of fire that lights the path before the religious individual, where does he get the idea of the pillar of fire? Where is he taking the Amud Eish? Huh? In the desert, right? Why is he using this term? He's using this term to explain, like the pillar of fire in the desert. The pillar of fire in the desert, it says, we were going in the wilderness. We were in a desert, How does it say in Parsha Sekev? Mokom nochosh v'akra v'shaloy moyim, a place of snakes and scorpions and no water. We were in a desert. And what led our path? What helped us to survive? This pillar of fire. So what is the Rav is not just using a nice poetical term. What does he mean to say? He means to say that if we take this conception of this ontological reality, this reality of these worlds that transcend us, that becomes the pillar of fire that lights our path. That will allow us to live in a better way. This awareness of these greater, more abstract, more pristine realms will make us live lives in a better way. What's that? Let's see further. The ladder of ethical perfection, like the biblical ladder of Jacob, is set fast upon the earth, upon the ground of concrete reality, and the top of it reaches into the very heavens. The ladder of ethical perfection, like the biblical ladder of Jacob, is set fast upon the earth, upon the ground of concrete reality, and the top of it reaches into the very heavens. What does that mean? It's going to allow a person to grow. This is what's going to allow a person to grow. The ethical and religious ideal of religious man is the extrication of existence from the bonds of this world. In other words, it then inspires a person to not want to remain within the bonds of this world, from the iron chains of empirical reality, its laws and judgments, and its elevation up to the level of being of a higher man in the world that is wholly good and wholly eternal. A person will want to lift himself up. The Rebbe is going to explain shortly what that means. But he's going to want to elevate himself to a higher level, a higher, more ethereal plane. The aim of religion is to liberate those who are bound in fetters and irons, those who dwell in darkness and gloom, the king held captive in tresses, and crown them all with the royal crown of a supernal, transcendental existence emanating from holy eternal realms. What's he saying here, the Rav? What does he mean to say to extricate oneself from the bonds of this world, to elevate oneself to the level of being of a higher man? Does he mean to be a suicide bomber? Does he mean to commit suicide? What does it mean? What does it mean to extricate yourself from the world? The aim of religion is to dwell those who dwell in darkness and gloom. The king held captive in tresses. Melech Aser Berahotim. Those of us that dwell in darkness and gloom and crown them with the royal crown of a supernal transcendental existence emanating from a holy eternal realm. What does that mean, a supernal transcendental existence? What does it mean to extricate ourselves from the world? What does that mean? Does it mean to kill ourselves? What does it mean? What does it mean to extricate ourselves from the darkness and gloom? It means to illuminate the world that we have. It means that the Rav is saying that religious man that perceives that there's a reality greater than the reality that we have wants to illuminate the world that we have with that reality. Doesn't want to remain captured in the world as we have it. How do you do that? That's what he's going to explain in the next paragraph. But the point that the Rav is saying, I always say, this is the way that I always explain it. There seems to be a machlekes between the Zohar and Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong sings, "What a Wonderful World," right? Louis Armstrong says it's a wonderful world. And he has a whole long list of things describing why it's such a wonderful world. The Zohar, on the other hand, which the Rav is referring to, is full of this, calls this world Olam Choshech Kaful Mechupol, a double world, double darkness, quadruple darkness, dark and gloom, extricate himself from the darkness of this world. This is such a dark, terrible world. So which is it? Do we say like Louis Armstrong that it's a wonderful world? Or do we say that it's a dark, quadruple darkness and gloomy world? Which the Zohar sometimes seems to be looking, remember Gargamel's castle? You know, when you have this dark, gloomy castle with like bats flying out of the windows and stuff, right? That's what the Zohar seems to be saying the world is. Chayshach, kafal, mechupal, dark world. So it's not a machlekes, the Zohar and Louis Armstrong. What the Zohar is saying is that you could live in a physical world and live in the physical life and just remain and see the beauty that the world has and the wonder that the world has and remain by just looking at it as a physical world, that's the darkness of the world. The darkness of the world is when you continue, we continue looking and living in the world and just seeing it as a physical world. And seeing it as something other than God. Seeing it as something other than transcendental realms. The Rav is saying ontological dualism, extricating oneself from the world, doesn't mean actually dying. Or the truth is, you know what we could say? It means dying while you're still alive. Dying while you're still alive means, like Chazal say, Mei shememis atzmai. Haroitza lichyos yomis atzmai. That's what Chazal say. Somebody that wants to live should die. What does that mean? Chazal say, Haroitza lichyos yomis atzmai. If you want to live, you should die. So what does that mean to be a fundamentalist, to actually kill oneself? What does it mean to die? What does Chazal mean? If you want to really live, you got to die. What does that mean? What does it mean to die? There's a great story of the Tzemach Tzedek. The Tzemach Tzedek one time was drunk. He had said a couple of lachaims. And all of a sudden he was dancing. And all of a sudden he jumped on the table. He started dancing on the table. Imagine, the Rebbe was dancing on the table. And then he said like this, "Shteit libi cholol bekirbi." Libi chol bekirbi. David HaMelech said, King David said, my heart is empty within me. He killed himself, right? Libi cholol bekirbi. My heart is empty within me. And Chazal say that he killed his Yetzirah. Libi cholol bekirbi. He had an empty chasm inside. And Tzemach Tzedek started dancing and he said, cholol is gematria chayim. Mehept on and under 11. Cholol, the word for chasm, means is same gematria as the word chaim, which means life. You begin a new life. If you kill yourself, you begin a new life, a whole new way of living. What does that mean, to kill yourself in order a whole new way of living? It means to not remain within the confines of seeing the world as we see it now, to go out of it, to daven, to close one's eyes, to think about Hashem, to think about those supernal realms, to think about those pristine abstract realms that the Rav is speaking about, die. Not want to remain within the world. Not remain connected to the physical world. And then when one opens one's eyes and then looks at the world again, you live. That's how you redeem the world. And that's what the Rav is saying. That's the pillar of fire that lights the path before the religious individual. It's the ability to be aware of higher realms and then see them in the world around you. Do you know why we close our eyes by Kriya Shema and by Shemona Esrei? So that we should be able to open them properly afterwards. You understand? The reason we close our eyes in the beginning of the day by Kriya Shema and by Shemona Esrei is so that when we open up our eyes later, after davening, we see the whole world in a whole new way. We die. We leave the world. We think of God and His infinity and the infinite realms. We perceive how lowly the physical world is, so that when we open up our eyes and agree with Louis Armstrong that it's a wonderful world, we see God within it. And that's the pillar of light, the pillar of fire that lights up our path. Let's see inside. Let's see further. This motif of what? Of seeking transcendence within existence. It winds its way through the whole experiential fabric of homo religiosus. Of course, this tendency takes on various, at times contradictory forms. So now the Rav is going to say, okay, so we're saying that the point is now to find this transcendence within immanence, to be able to find these transcendent realms within the world. What does that mean, lemaisa? So the Rav is now going to say that motif has two contradictory paths. Now that I understand that I need to seek this higher realm, when I actually approach the world, there are two contradictory paths telling me how to approach the world. Listen, look what he says. And this is what he goes on to speak now from now to the end of the chapter. These two contradictory paths. How do I find God? How do I find God while I'm alive? How do I die in order to live? How do I do that? So he says, this tendency takes on various, at times contradictory forms. Sometimes the craving for transcendence clothes itself in an ascetic garb. Sometimes those that are seeking transcendence, that are seeking to get closer to God, they take a garb, a garment of asceticism. What does asceticism mean? Not being involved in the physical world. Negating physicality. Denying oneself any physical pleasure, any physical indulgence. In an act of negation of life and of this world, in a denial of the worthwhile nature of existence. Some people will say, you know how you die? Literally. Die. Literally means to completely negate oneself and run out of the world. To deny oneself any connection to the world. We very often like to say, we Jewish people like to say, that this is something that Christianity was very into. Asceticism. Which is certainly true. Christianity definitely glorifies as saints those that lived life of complete asceticism, that completely denied themselves indulgence, not just in married life, but of course in eating and, you know, wearing uncomfortable clothing. And the Jews like to say that it's a very Christian thing to be ascetics, to deny oneself the world. I'm sure anyone that knows that the history of Judaism and Torah knows that that's not true. It wasn't just the Christians. Anyone that reads about the Hasidei Ashkenaz, I gotta tell you, it's hard to think that Yiddishkeit has so many different paths. You know, we speak about different paths to finding God in different religions. Judaism itself, it's fascinating to see how contradictory these contradictory paths are found within Torah itself. You ever read Hasidei Ashkenaz? You ever read what they did? I mean, I don't want to get gory, but it was pretty nasty. I mean, they did some things that were pretty nasty. Hasidei Ashkenaz, there were these Jews at the time of the Middle Ages, which, by the way, coincidentally, lived in Christian countries. Hasidei Ashkenaz lived in Christian countries, so I'm not sure who received from whom. But the Hasidei Ashkenaz were noyeg to spend their nights sleeping in anthills, allowing anthills. They would sleep with insects. So the insects should go over them, bite them, roll around in the snow, you know, forget about eating, you know, barely eating anything. They would really torture themselves. They would wear clothing, sock, which we know is found as sock, not just the sock, which means wearing really uncomfortable clothing or clothing made out of hair, to really torture themselves, to mortify themselves. By the way, anyone know Mishnah Perkei Avos that seems to say that? Oh, it says there are sources in Chazal for that. Chazal say, Kachi Darka Shel Torah, a person that wants to acquire Torah, Pas B'melech Toichal, Main B'mesurat Tishte, Chaye Tzar Tichye, Im Tasaken Ashecha B'Elam Hazav Toiv L'Chal Elam Haba. This is the path of Torah. Eat bread with salt. Measure the amount of water that you drink. Live a life of pain. If you do that, praiseworthy are this world and the next world. By the way, you know how the Hungarians read that Mishnah? With a question mark, right. That's the Hungarians read it. Kachi darka shel Torah. Kachi darka shel Torah. You think that's the way of Torah? Pas b'melech Toichal. Maim surat tishta. Chai tzar tichya. No, you have to live in such a way of a shrecha b'olam hazav, a tev l'cha l'olam haba. That's how the Hungarians read it. But obviously, poshup shat is not like that. So there are definitely found within Judaism plenty of sources that seem to say this craving for transcendence that clothes itself in an ascetic garb. We find that in Judaism too. And on the other hand, you'll find menakotze l'akotze. You'll find other places that will say the opposite. Let's see further. In an act of negation of life and of this world, in a denial of the worthwhile nature of existence. The longing of homoreligiosis for a supernal world that extends beyond the bounds of concrete reality has been embodied in many doctrines of asceticism, renunciation, and self-affliction. And by the way, even in Hasidus, You'll find, as much as we like to say that by Hasidim, the Baal Shem Tov and his students came to say that specifically that not negate physicality, there are plenty of schools in Hasidus that were very ascetic. There were schools of Hasidism that did not believe in indulgence, that believed in asceticism to extremes, especially tzaddikim, right? Even as far as the Ruzhiner, the holy Ruzhiner, seemingly the greatest example of the opposite of asceticism was the Ruzhiner, right? The holy Ruzhiner, Bistro Ruzhiner, went like a king. He went like a king. He had golden carriage, white horses, he had a palace, a mansion. He lived literally like a king, to the extent that the Tzans, the Chassidim of Tzans, fought against him, because they were so disgusted by his indulgence. But I'm sure you've heard that this Ruzhiner that would go with silk clothing and would go like a king, one time by Kiddush Levana, it was icy outside, and he was standing in one place too long, and when he moved away, they saw that there was blood under the ice. There was blood under his feet, because he would go, even though his shoes looked like they were made of gold, but they were lacking soles. And he was wearing royal clothing, but under it was garments of that were causing him pain. That were causing him pain. Because he thought that he had to appear in such a garb, but he himself lived a life of asceticism. You find this tension in Chassidus also. There's an interesting story, they say over, that one time, Reb Shlomo Karliner, the holy Reb Shlomo Karliner, was visiting one time in Liozhna by the Alter Rebbe. And there was Tisha B'Av. And there was a chassid known as Reb Shmuel Munkus. Reb Shmuel Munkus was a chassid of the Alter Rebbe who was known for having an extremely well-developed sense of humor. He was known for being very funny, and he made a lot of funny jokes. So they say one time it was Tisha B'Av. And the Jews were sitting around, you know, sitting and crying and the Churban. So Shmuel Munkus decided that he wanted to have cheer things up. So he tied to the door a bucket full of water in such a way that whoever would be the first next one that would walk into the room, the bucket of water would pour all over them. And he set that up. He rigged the door in such a way to cheer things up on Tisha B'Av because he couldn't handle the sadness that was going on. So he set up that pail of water, and who do you think walked in? The first next one to walk in was Reb Shlomo Karliner. Reb Shlomo Karliner and the Alter Rebbe walk in, and the bucket falls, and Reb Shlomo Karliner gets completely wet, and everyone is laughing. And Reb Shlomo Karliner says, Reb Shmuel Munkus, he says, because of such younger light, that's why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. That's how upset he got. Because of such younger light, because of such people, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And the story goes that a couple of hours later, the Alter Rebbe and Shlomo Karliner were walking through the forest. And they're walking, discussing very deep ideas. And they're walking, and all of a sudden, as they're walking deep, deep into the forest, they hear a sound of somebody groaning from pain. And they see the same Shmuel Munkus lying on an anthill with their ants or insects that bite, and he was letting himself being bitten by these insects. As he wanted to cheer up other Jews, but he himself was torturing himself. And Reb Shlomo Karliner saw this and he said, because of such younger light, the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt. Meaning that you see these tzaddikim, these chassidim, were very into asceticism, very into extricating oneself from the world, seemingly. Let's go further. At such moments, Homer religiosus is of the opinion that sufferings and torments, fasting and seclusion are the means which convey eternal felicity to man and bring him under the wings of the supernal. The individual who foregoes worldly pleasures and renounces temporal life, it's only by foregoing worldly pleasure, renouncing temporal life will merit, according to this view, eternal life and a lofty, exalted existence. Now, what I want to just point out before we go further is very important. What you see from Rav Soloveitchik over here in this paragraph, he's speaking about the ascetic impulse, that impulse of rejecting physicality. But there are two things that we need to say about this ascetic impulse that we need to point out. Because again, as I said, there are those streams in Torah that seem to say that there is a place for such a thing, including a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Yeah? Two things we need to point out. Number one, nobody, including the Christians, nobody believed in asceticism for the sake of asceticism. Nobody believed, because nobody believed in self-flagellation or denying oneself simply because they were self-hating. It's very common to portray people that seek, you know, this ascetic impulse as being depressed people and people that just were not interested in the world and they were very, you know, morose people. What does this ascetic impulse come from? Why are these people denying themselves, renouncing temporal life? Why? What's it coming from? It's coming from a geshmak, a pleasure in Elokus, in God. It's coming from the fact that they feel the beauty in God and the desire to be closer to Hashem. That's what causes the rejection of temporal life. It's not coming because people just want to torture themselves. Right? Number two, it's not because God loves pain. There are those that like to say that the reason that the God of wants pain and he enjoys pain, there's a, you know, famous book of human bondage written by Morgan that he writes over there. You know, he describes that he was taught as a child that God only will accept your prayer if you're in pain, because God loves when a person is in pain. And there's this whole, you know, concept of that people that deny themselves physicality is because God loves pain. Chas v'shalom. This, what the Rav is saying over here, that ascetic impulse is coming when people feel the pleasure of elokus, of godliness, and they feel that it's worth it. They joyfully reject the world because they feel themselves getting closer to God. It's not coming from because they're depressed people. As much as they try to portray it, whether it's Jews or Christians, these people were not depressed people. These people felt the pleasure of godliness and they joyfully renounced physical pleasure. And by the way, that's why the tzaddikim taught that in our generation we're not shaykh to it. It doesn't make sense for us to fast. You know, when we fast, we just end up meditating about orange juice. Right? We have long, deep meditations about Tropicana. When these people were fasting, they were able to feel God in a deeper way. We know what it, when we fast, we're feeling the coffee and cake in a deeper way. You know, but by Minchan Yom Kippur, I don't think it, you know, the pleasure of coffee and cake that you have when you're contemplating on Minchan Yom Kippur probably could compete with actually tasting it. We have very long, drawn-out meditations about the Tropicana. These people felt God. So we have to understand it was coming from the fact that they wanted to get closer to Hashem. That's where this impulse is coming from. But the bottom line, what we have to take in our lives, even though we're not on that level, to seek such asceticism, what do we have to take for us? Well, we have to understand for us what that means for us in our lives is to understand that even though we are on the level that we do need to drink the orange juice and we need to have our cups of coffee because we're not on the level that we could renounce it. But we do have to know that there were people, not just tzaddikim, people that lived a life of godliness in such a way that they felt that prayer was more pleasurable than oranges. They felt that the siddur was more, or a prayer book, or the Bible is more geschmack than a piece of cake. So we have to have that awareness. It might be that we're not at a level that we could go a day without the cup of coffee, we could go a day without having a piece of chicken and steak. We need that. That's fine. But we have to at least know that people lived in such a way. And that's the truth of reality. That's what these people took, that ascetic garb. They were aware of the geshmak of Elokus. And Mirtz Hashem, we should all merit to have a taste of that. We should merit to have that time that we're going to feel a pasuk of Tehillim is more delicious than a piece of cake. Halavai, we should merit it tonight, Mirtz Hashem.
How many didn't?